Charlie, colleagues, above all, if I may say so, students, thank you, Charlie, for the warmth and generosity of that welcome. And thank you for coming, and coming in such impressive numbers, coming in the hope that it's going to be a worthwhile lecture and potentially exchange of views thereafter. I must emphasise that, so far as I'm concerned, it's a huge honour as well as a pleasure to be addressing the Political Studies Association on this occasion. As an undergraduate student in government myself at the University of Essex more than 25 years ago, I benefited enormously from the wisdom of my professors, even if some of them might think that it took an awfully long time for some of their messages to get through to me. The world of political ideas, theories, and institutions is still a world that fascinates me, and I cannot applaud with more enthusiasm the activities of the Political Studies Association. More power to you because of the work you do and the range of disciplines and experience that you represent. You embrace theory and practice. The Political Studies Association has academics, it has active teachers, it has an engagement with researchers, with higher education more widely, with journalists, with practicing politicians like myself and David Plunkett, who was here earlier. And very importantly, you're working to forge those links with the next generation of citizens who are the future of our country and, in a very real sense, the future of our democracy as well. So it's great to have such a full and hopefully enthusiastic audience. The title which I'm addressing today is What Should a 21st Century Parliament Look Like? If there are those in the audience who fear that this might be the cause of a very dry exposition on the precise details of the reform of the House of Commons as I see it that is required, concern yourselves no more. I have already delivered a number of those orations in the course of 2012, and I recommend those endured by the universities of Birmingham, London, and especially Hull, if you would like to avail yourselves of them. What I want instead to do is to stand back and to look not at the small brushstrokes, but rather at the big picture. For it seems to me that before one can attempt to construct a remotely intelligent answer to the question, what should a 21st century parliament look like, a seemingly different but truly seminal question has first to be encountered and addressed. Namely, what does 21st century British democracy look like? For if the House of Commons in our time does not reflect the character of democracy in our time, then it is frankly destined to become a less consequential institution to citizens and thus less consequential politically. I would therefore like today to engage in what some would describe as an extremely ambitious, even a very audacious undertaking. I want to make an argument in front of a set of eminent political scientists and politics students about the meaning of democracy in the modern era. I am aware that this is a high-risk enterprise in which to engage. It's a little like offering God a view on the real meaning of life. What I want to sketch out here, however, is a personal reflection on the times in which we live. My central proposition is that the old and very lively debate between representative or devolved democracy and direct or popular democracy has lost whatever value it might have enjoyed. What we're witnessing instead is the steady entrenchment of what I will describe today as dynamic democracy. From this, I now want to make three further propositions. The first is that if parliaments are to be as consequential in the present and the future as at their best they have been in the past, then their internal balance between the chamber and their committees will need to become more flexible. The second is that a truly modern parliament will need to engage in constant internal innovation and to be much more accessible externally. The third is that legislatures are much more likely to achieve this desirable state of affairs if they pay more attention than in the past to what other parliamentary bodies are doing. The case for a really internationalist mindset has never been stronger. Let me then turn straight away to my central observation. Definitions of democracy are, of course, many, varied, and not infrequently uncertain. It is a malleable enough term that the old East Germany felt able to describe itself, or perhaps I should say, felt obliged to describe itself, as the German Democratic Republic. And it is today North Korea, not South Korea, which seeks to incorporate the word democratic in its title. It is, colleagues, a strange but intriguing tribute to the power of democracy as a word and as an ideal, that even those individuals and those regimes which are absolutely determined to hold a monopoly over political authority and legitimacy feel compelled to cloak themselves in the language of democracy, even if they are, and perhaps especially if they are, at total odds with it in their practice. Democratic theorists have, and for very many years have, been interested in a different issue. They have ceaselessly sought to debate the merits of devolved or representative democracy on the one hand, and direct or popular democracy on the other. They've also attempted to assess whether the direction of actual democratic practice is observably toward one route or the other. In the first model, the electors are relatively passive and the elected extremely active. Under devolved democracy, the voter is king in that he or she invests political power in a small set of representatives through ballots cast at elections. In the interim, however, those political representatives exercise power, mindful, obviously, of public opinion, but to a degree rather distant from it. They seek, colleagues, the sanction of their fellow citizens at the next election, but feel at liberty to chart their own policy course meanwhile, and to await endorsement or rejection at the end of, usually, a 4 or 5 year parliament when the electorate re-emerges from virtual hibernation to wear the crown again. Against this devolved democracy notion is posited the concept of direct democracy. Its advocates contend that there is an unstoppable momentum towards a world in which the electorate is the activist actor and those elected to a parliament comparatively passive. In a direct democracy, voters will, whether through formal initiatives, plebiscites and referendums, or more informally via opinion polls, public campaigns and pressure group activity, set the public policy agenda on an almost daily basis. The role of elected parliamentarians in this scenario is little more than to reflect the sentiment of the moment inside their chambers. Numerous politicians across multiple democracies have proclaimed that the age of devolved democracies is drawing to a close and that direct democracies are imminent. The rise of new technology, which speeds the process by which popular sentiment can be expressed, has, it is postulated, provided the means by which this revolutionary transition can finally be implemented. I am not convinced by this apparently irresistible supposition. It seems to me to be divorced from the realities of human life and democratic expression. It assumes that all citizens have clear opinions on all issues and at all hours. It assumes that no value is vested in political leadership. It assumes that the whole of our citizenry has the time, as well as the inclination, to engage in permanent democratic interaction. It assumes that the array of opinions which might be expressed at a particular time have a permanent rather than a fluid quality to them. It assumes that the opinions being expressed are consistent with each other and coherent. It assumes that parliaments are basically museums and elected members mere curators. These are, to put it mildly, very bold assumptions. In my judgment, they are not especially credible. The reality of life, I would put it to you, is somewhat different. It includes these important elements: citizens collectively definitely do want to play a part beyond pure devolved democracy. A substantial section of citizens do want a degree of participation along the lines of direct democracy on a limited and personal set of issues, but not the entire policy landscape. There is the risk that this diversity of democratic ambition will lead to an inequality of democratic outcomes as the loudest voices and with most free time drown out what may be a silent majority. There is a level of popular opposition to a policy or a series of policies which is broad and strong and determined enough to constitute an effective veto on an actual or proposed course of action. Beyond this, though, politicians still retain considerable capacity for policy innovation, even if the measure concerned would not pass an instant poll of public opinion if submitted to such a survey. What all of this means is that we have neither a devolved democracy nor a direct democracy. We have instead something which might be best described as a dynamic democracy. Voters are not passive players in a devolved democracy model, nor are they as assertive as the direct democracy argument would have it. The same, frankly, is true for parliamentarians and parliaments. Power is shared between these two sections, not held uniquely by one or the other. And that dynamism means that the balance of power is constantly changing across policy issues, depending upon particular circumstances and the wider temperature of the times. This is not an environment, furthermore, in which politicians and the public are the only actors. There are other crucial figures, not least the media, which modern technology has rendered both more omnipresent and more fragmented than in the past, and interest or pressure groups, which are again both more intense and more diverse now than before. The central and new challenge for older democracies such as Britain is how our political, and especially how our parliamentary institutions respond to dynamic democracy. For, to be candid, our constitutional frameworks were never designed with dynamic democracy in mind. What does all this mean for a modern parliament and for modern parliamentarians? It seems to me to have profound implications for the manner in which we do democratic business. First, it means thinking carefully about the balance between the chamber and committees in how we conduct our business. Classic parliamentarians have long treated the whole and the parts as if they were rivals to one another. In the contemporary age, this is, if I may say so, completely the wrong approach. To meet the demands of dynamic democracy, we have to accept that expression is frequently, but not exclusively, best delivered through the chamber, but that inquisition is regularly, but again, not uniquely, best achieved by committees. There has been a great leap forward for select committees, which has allowed, for example, the Treasury Select Committee to be conceded a veto over appointments to the Office of Budget Responsibility. An absolutely intriguing precedent. And for the Select Committee on Culture, Media and Sport to assume centre stage in the investigation into News International and telephone hacking. Just as dynamic democracy is fluid, so we must be organisationally fluid. Until recently, the Select Committee system in Britain, although it had many strong points, was frankly undermined by its lack of institutional independence from the executive through the executive's agents, the whips. In 2010, this was swept away through a dramatic series of reforms which ensured that the chairs of the various select committees were elected by the whole House and members chosen by their party caucus. We have already witnessed a sea change in the status and self-confidence of these committees. This is not only a positive development in terms of the checks and balances of the British political system, I also think, colleagues, that it will enable the House of Commons to meet the demands of dynamic democracy. The select committee structure, through the call for evidence, witnesses and hearings, can invite the public into parliamentary proceedings in a fashion which it is frankly impossible for the chamber itself to achieve. Secondly, the challenges associated with a dynamic democracy mean that we must be remorselessly relevant to the electorate in our discussions. If we fail this test, then we can hardly complain if we seem to surrender sovereignty to the media. We need to be talking about today's issues today, and better still, tomorrow's issues today, not yesterday's issues today, or even worse, yesterday's issues tomorrow. In the House of Commons, I have done my best to move proceedings in a more topical manner. We have a device called an urgent question, capital U, capital Q, which allows any member of Parliament to ask the Speaker to call a minister to Parliament at very little notice to respond to an issue, domestic or international, which has emerged suddenly and is clearly of some significance. This is actually quite an old parliamentary mechanism, but one which had fallen into disuse recently. In the year before I became Speaker in June 2009, only two urgent questions were accepted. Since I had the privilege of being elected Speaker almost 3 years ago, some 91 urgent questions have been submitted to ministers across the floor of the House of Commons. I have also sought to encourage a shift away from very general debates on very general subjects, such as the economy or foreign affairs, to shorter and sharper debates on immediate controversies. I have urged our select committees of the House of Commons to focus on matters which are of a clear and instant interest to the electorate, not just of interest to parliamentarians. It seems to me that this focus on relevance is a vital response to the demands of a dynamic democracy. It also means that we have to ask searching questions about the manner and about the style in which parliamentary business is conducted. We have, as you all realise, many traditions in the way that we address each other as parliamentarians, and particular language of which we are understandably proud. But we have to be willing to ask ourselves if we are speaking in a vocabulary and a fashion which is incomprehensible to the outside world. We can hardly protest ruefully that we are misunderstood by the electorate if we do not address them in their own tongue. It would be like issuing instructions to a Greek audience while speaking only in Latin. It is to consider matters such as these that I established a Speaker's Advisory Council on Public Engagement in November 2009, consisting of expert outsiders to offer me completely fresh thinking on this matter and many other pertinent matters as well. Finally, in this section, in a dynamic democracy, a Parliament cannot afford to behave as a private club rather than a public institution. It was 3 years ago that the saga known as the expenses scandal was revealed by the Telegraph and soon made for sensational headlines worldwide. It was a total disaster for our reputation. The process of abandoning the old discredited system and moving to one of independent assessment, which is fair to members of Parliament and the taxpayer alike, has been an incredibly painful one. And I would be dishonest if I claimed that all the controversies here had been settled. There is still much more to be done before we can assert that the ideal balance has been achieved. There is, nonetheless, no chance of a retreat to the old world of cosy secrecy, where the test of what seemed to be an acceptable expense claim was one to be largely determined by MPs alone or through a culture which was transmitted to the officials who had to oversee the process. For if a dynamic democracy has one single feature which runs through it like a spine, then it is surely transparency. Where advocates of direct democracy are right is that the norms of devolved democracy, in which the public elects a parliament which then looks after itself, are doomed. The expenses debacle is a salutary reminder of the extent to which the world has changed, and the House has had to change too. From this, the first of my two supplementary propositions follows. It is that if a parliament is to retain the place in national democratic life that it should aspire to, it will need to innovate in more than the formal proceedings which take place inside of its debating chamber. That innovation comes in a number of forms. One of those is the need to embrace modern technology with enormous vigour. The House of Commons website is a magnificent resource, and when used in conjunction with the fabulous output of the BBC, especially its Democracy Live feature, which allows viewers to observe events in the UK Parliament, the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Assembly, the Northern Ireland Assembly and the European Parliament, affords the interested citizen both an astonishing array of vital information and a front row seat at our democracy. The work of the House website has to be supplemented, crucially, by a parliamentary presence on the likes of Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. In all of these efforts, furthermore, we need to encourage citizens to become engaged in our democracy through, for example, calls for material from the public at large to our many select committee inquiries. Parliaments and parliamentarians often appear to regard technological change as a threat to them. This is emphatically mistaken. It is the means, technological change, by which we can, through adjustment to it and use of it, render ourselves relevant in the modern world. The internet alone is not an adequate strategy in the age of dynamic democracy. We need a process of in-reach in which citizens from throughout the country are encouraged to visit what is, after all, their parliament, and for this to be an enriching experience for them. To that end, I've sought to open up Parliament to the public, to offer many more tours of the Palace of Westminster, and to create an education centre, which we are in the midst of doing, so that hundreds of thousands of school children can experience the Palace of Westminster in person. The public owns Parliament. The public should see it. That in-reach has to be complemented by outreach. One of my central objectives as Speaker has been to champion this initiative of outreach, of which my engagement with and the Lord Speaker, Baroness de Suisman's engagement with this conference is an example. Francis and I both feel very strongly that it's writ large in our set of duties. We now have a small team of able professionals working across the entire United Kingdom promoting what Parliament does to the public, and I try to take the opportunity of parliamentary recesses to travel outside London and then address audiences throughout the United Kingdom. We did not have an outreach programme with any coherent structure a little more than 5 years ago, in large part because Parliament and parliamentarians did not think that such an enterprise was necessary or even desirable. In a dynamic democracy, it is an absolutely fundamental exercise. It's a legitimate criticism of Parliament that 3 years now before the 800th anniversary of the signing of the Magna Carta, we can say that we've had a parliamentary outreach service for only less than 5 years. We are open to criticism for that, but neither Francis de Sousa nor I can reinvent the past. All we can do in our two parts of Parliament is to try to change the present and chart the future. I'm doing my bit in my House of Parliament, and you might be interested to know and to take on board that Baroness de Sousa, as only the second Lord Speaker, made it absolutely clear in standing for election that her overriding focus and key priority would be outreach. For reasons I won't bore you with now, the roles of the Speaker in the Lords are a bit different from the role in the Commons. The outreach function, so far as the Lords is concerned and its Speaker is concerned, is absolutely centre stage. This brings me to my second supplementary supposition. This is the vital importance of swiftly discovering how other legislatures are meeting the new challenge of dynamic democracy. I've borrowed many ideas about in-reach and outreach from the relatively new Scottish Parliament, Welsh Assembly and Northern Ireland Assembly, and from other parliaments in Europe and elsewhere. I'm sure that there is much more useful out there to be found. This demands a change in cultural mindset, not just travelling across the planet. The information is there, but we've not yet found the ideal formula for exchanging it. We all need to work much harder on this. In the United States, the individual states have been called laboratories of democracy. Parliaments must see themselves in the same light. Colleagues, it has been my privilege to present these thoughts to you in this closing plenary. They are offered by a practitioner of politics who remains committed to promoting the study and the appreciation of politics. They come also from someone who is an unapologetic advocate of democracy, whether it be in Britain or in Burma. There are times when it seems to be fashionable to be cynical about politics and sceptical as to whether democracy is all that it is cracked up to be and whether it can survive the sharp challenge offered from authoritarian state capitalism. I am neither a cynic nor a sceptic. I think my optimism is fortified by the widespread appreciation that the House of Commons is in a considerably better condition as a political institution today than it was after the nadir of the expenses scandal. We have much more to do to meet the demands of our dynamic democracy, but at least we appreciate the task ahead of us. In all that we do, I know that we should heed, and I hope that we will heed, the counsel of the Political Studies Association and that of those in this audience. I have said enough now. It is time, through your questions, for me to hear you. Thank you very much indeed.